from Eastern Europe to Western Europe. Obviously, the Hasidim did not touch the West, and equally obviously, the Haftarah was a movement that came from the West to Eastern Europe rather than the other way around. One word I should say about something that may have struck you about what Mr. Orbach said last time, namely the undue influence from Germany rather than from any other Western country. That is due not only to the fact that, let us say, the French Jewish community was very small indeed, some 80,000. The German Jewish community was much larger, some 200,000, not to speak of Austria. Not only because the German influence came in through Galicia, which was, remember, a part of the Austrian Empire, but also the fact that Germany was near, and that in effect, something we should remember for later, the Pale, the settlement of Eastern European Jews, was at the borders of Germany. We must also add to that, perhaps, the fact that, after all, in Germany, not only was political thought pioneered in the 19th century, but also that thought which effected Jewish development from Moses Mendelssohn to the Hegelian influences, all these were German phenomena. The density of the German predominance among Jewish thought in general, you can see again by something that comes up later. When in 1907 you have the famous language controversy within Zionism. And that language controversy was whether the language of Zionism should be Hebrew or German. And German lost out by a very narrow margin, something that I have had the greatest reason to regret. It lost out by a very narrow margin. So you can see that within Zionism itself, in the end, how predominant German was to be. I do not have to tell you that neither Theodor Herzl nor Max Nordau knew any Hebrew whatsoever. So that there too, the German influence, and we shall see more of that, as German was extremely dense. Now the question in the West, unlike the East, was never whether to be emancipated or not, but how far to be emancipated. And within the context of emancipation, how to respond to the new wave of anti-Semitism. For let us remember that in the West, the Jews are not regarded as a nation, and indeed were not. That they lived, as I have told you before, scattered among the Christian population. Thus the problem of identity is here a very serious one, much more serious than it will be in Eastern Europe with its density of settlement. Neither really the Hasidim nor the Haftarah raised the problem of identity to that extent. And here I must interrupt myself to answer a question which some of you have asked from the beginning. The question of identity, the question of what is a Jew, obviously does not come into focus until modern times. It does not really come into focus until emancipation is seriously challenged, which will be in the time with which we are now about to deal. It was not a problematic of Eastern European Jewry. But from the 1870s, anti-Semitism together as a whole. For we are now passing into the 20th century. I have quite purposefully not said anything about the problem of Jewish identity, for one thing, it is only now going to be raised very seriously. Nor have I said anything about the other problem that you always want to know about, the problem of Jewish survival. For our purposes here, both questions of Jewish identity and Jewish survival are not theological questions, but strictly historical questions. The answer comes to us from history, and therefore they come to us from the problem that we have discussed, and above all from the problem I am about to discuss. And if the problem of Jewish survival is soluble at all, about which I have my great doubt, and if the problem of Jewish identity is soluble at all, about which I have the greater doubt, then we must discuss it at the end of our endeavor, not at the beginning, or not at the middle. That is something for the very end of the course, because it arises out of the historical problem, the concrete historical problem that Jews have to face. And the problems of survival and identity do not, at least as far as our efforts are concerned, arise from any theological idea. That is not debatable. If you believe it, fine. If you don't believe it, you don't believe it. But for us, these are historical questions, which we shall try in the end to answer in a historical way. The crisis of assimilation, then, spans the years from 1870 on, though the foundations, remember, are always laid by emancipation and by the rise of modern anti-Semitism, which we have discussed already. For the years which immediately concern us at the moment, from 1870 to 1914, that is to the outbreak of the First World War, the problems of identity must be raised again in a particular context, namely Jewish survival in good as in bad times. For I must remind you, and I must remind you above all, because you have been nicely brainwashed with the idea that Jewish history, or some of you have been brainwashed with the idea that Jewish history is a continuous catastrophe, on which, of course, much Zionism has to be built, because if it isn't a catastrophe, why go to Palestine eventually? So that what you have been brainwashed is that it is a continuous catastrophe, which is, of course, errant nonsense. So the question is quite clearly the survival in good as in bad times, which needs to be explained. And its difficulty is that it is always stressed that there were only bad times. For in one sense, the years from 1870 to 1940 are, of course, the time of great capitalist development, great capitalist prosperity, the foundation for the great Jewish fortunes were founded and set in this age, and indeed many Jews got a new feeling of security in the West, while from the East the immigrants took on a tidal wave. But this security was accompanied by what we might call threatening noises and events, and yet sporadic. As yet, forever. But whatever the threatening noises and events were, with which we shall deal in a minute, it is clear that among Jews, the force of emancipation, rationalism, and liberalism went forth. Indeed, the forces of new threats interacted in a way, dialectically, with the new feeling of security. The growth of racism, the beginning of racism, really, continue the idea of emancipation in bad times, or what else were you going to do? And here I will talk about the man who typifies it better than any other. I will talk about Sigmund Freud. Secondly, the idea to transcend being Jewish, for as you will see, very good and sufficient reasons in a sense. And you could transcend that into socialism, and you could transcend it into nationalism. Not Jewish nationalism, but German nationalism, or French nationalism, or whatever have you. These are some of the themes which must now occupy us. But occupy us always on the rock which we have laid in the first half of the 19th century. What is basic to this crisis from which these changes arose, changes in Jewish behavior, of which some of you are the product? Basic in all of this is something that was as yet dimly realized, but that, we can put it this way, this is the beginning of the rug being pulled out under. What was the rug on which the Jews had stood? Stood, were going to stand, even when it no longer existed. That rug was liberalism. Jewish faith now, after 1870, becomes intimately involved with the crisis of liberalism. For it is liberalism which stood for rationalism, emancipation, and tolerance. And as I told you before, it is the liberal party which the Jews joined, through which they tried to activate their new citizenship, and through which they penetrated into politics. It must be clear, therefore, that we have here then is a crisis of liberalism. And that crisis of liberalism is connected with two things. First of all, a rising new nationalism, which comes both with German unification and the dissatisfaction with unification, the kind of unification that came about in Germany. A new nationalism that comes in France with the instability of the Third Republic, founded in 1879. So it is the new nationalism that will produce, on one hand, on one side, the crisis of liberalism. But on the other side, it is combined with the new mass movement and mass politics. Mass movements and mass politics, which squeeze liberalism from the other side, for the idea of rationalism, of enlightenment, of tolerance, could have very little place in mass movement and mass politics. What was the result? The result was that liberalism itself changed after 1807. And liberalism gradually made its peace with nationalism, moved ever further to the right. And as liberalism moved ever further to the right, one small minority within liberalism attempted to keep the old traditions alive. That small minority, after 1870s, formed a political party, usually called the Progressive Party. Surprisingly, in German, the Progressive Party, which tried to keep it alive. This was the party now which Jews joined, into which Jews went. So then here indeed Hannah Arendt is quite correct. The push of mass politics, the push of nationalism after 1870, pushed the Jews into a weak political position. By and large, they became a progressive, tied now to what remained of the old liberalism. across the distance. Until 1880, 70% of the Jews in politics in Germany belonged to the ruling government party. Now that makes sense, as you know from your reading of Arendt. But the change of the liberals made it quite different. In 1914, you find only 25% of Jews belonging to government parties, the rest in opposition. Still more startling, in 1878, 15% of Jewish politicians were socialists, that is, belonged to the Social Democratic Party. By 1914, it was 39% of Jewish politicians who belonged to the Social Democratic Party. That is more than double. At the same time, there were less and less Jews in public life. From 68 deputies in the Diet who were Jews in 78, 38 in 1914. It has dropped by more than 50%. What these statistics mean is quite clear. The Jews were being squeezed and driven into opposition for the reasons that I have tried to tell you. Mostly, they were not socialists, but progressives. That is to say, those liberals which refused to become nationalists, or national liberals, as we call them, nationalists or national liberals. The Jews, therefore, were losing their political base at the same time that you have a new wave of anti-Semitism. The same development that you have in Germany, you have in Austria as well. From the 1880s on, Austrian liberals became soft on anti-Semitism. There again you have the same shift of the liberals to the right, the same isolation of the Jews, the same losing of their political base and being driven to opposition to government. Now, this is important. For at the same time that this was happening, the other non-socialist political parties were pulled in the same direction. For us, most important is the evolution of the conservative party. For the conservatives, remember, were anti-Semitic, but negatively so. They avoided Jews. Now, they did not have an active anti-Semitism. Their anti-Semitism was Christian and hierarchical, but never active. But after 1880, the conservatives, if they wanted to survive, also had to become a mass party. And in this, like the liberals, only more so, of course, they became a popular movement and of Christ, and at the same time linked themselves with a more active, as you will see, and violent anti-Semitism. Now, to be sure, the conservatives regretted this in the end. And you will see that the anti-Semitic mass movement fought the conservatives. For the conservatives were never happy with the demons they had eventually raised. They were too aristocratic, too conservative, too hierarchical, too like any mass party. And eventually they turned against the kind of popular anti-Semitic movement which they had at first furthered. But the important thing is that an established party furthered it and was indeed, if anything, ambivalent about it from this kind of beginning. And that is what is important. To sum up then, by the 1880s, the change of the political constellation was such, this you must now remember, to erode the political base of emancipation had really been built in Jewish citizenship. Duly wrote it. Vote for the liberals. The conservatives taught how this erosion now penetrates into other established parties. Agrarian, conservative, but not only those, for the liberals also were taught of anti-Semitism, especially when the Jews joined the progressives. The liberals no longer had a Jewish constituency of importance, and so they no longer had to pay any attention to this whatsoever. As I said before, this is connected, first of all, to the rising nationalism, and second of all, to the rising mass politics, to both of these factors. How then did it express itself? And now we must come then to a new mass movement, attempted or otherwise, with which Jewish faith is and was so closely to be linked from now on in. We have already seen something of it. The Hap-Hap riots of 1819, on which many of you wrote so eloquently, if mistakenly. The Hap-Hap riots of 1918, you will at least remember. But these riots were only sporadic. They did not carry through. A riot is not a mass movement. A riot is spontaneous. If you are 5 blocks away, what does it matter? A riot, therefore, is politically important only for two reasons. It is politically only important, first, if it is a symptom. A symptom which might eventually become a mass movement. Then, it is important. And secondly, it can be important for creating slogans and ideas which then penetrate in various ways. These sporadic anti-Semitic riots, which we have studied, undoubtedly helped spread the Jewish stereotype. They produced flyers, they produced pictures, they produced novels, they produced theories, and in this way help to spread the stereotype. But by itself, it is obvious, and many of you have experience in riots, that riots by itself is nothing. We must therefore begin our story with the first movement, which wasn't merely a riot, but the movement which seemed to show, if people had only realized it at the time, that anti-Semitism indeed had great possibilities for the age of mass movement, and that indeed it could be connected to respectable political parties. The eventual strength of anti-Semitism, and I might say that here, the development which now comes with the Stöcker movement in Berlin, first of all, is that anti-Semitism, to be really effective, has to be double strong. We haven't had that up to now. Has to have two parts to it. We haven't had that up to now. It has to have two parts. One, a mass movement, running, but the other, a movement within the establishment. That is a respectable movement. At least with many people think respect. So that you can get a double strong attack. People in top hats and mourning coats on the one hand, and mass movements and demagogues on the other. Only in this way can you get a broad enough spread to make it effective. What I'm leading up, of course, here is, in a sense, if you like, to the Nazi movement, which had that two-pronged attack. The total respectability on the one hand, in top hat, frock coat, and on the other hand, the power of a mass movement. The case of Kurt Friedrich Stöcker from 1878 to 1890 is enlightened in this regard. I won't go into detail because you will read it in my private book, some of it. But there are some things that I want to point out. Adolf Strecker was a conservative, a member, in fact, of the Conservative Party. Moreover, he was an Orthodox Protestant minister. He was a preacher at court. You didn't become a preacher at the court of William II if you were a screwball, or as most of you think of Eastern European Jews. You know, that's dreadful in your exams. Your prejudices are beyond belief, because the consensus of the class is that Eastern European Jews are, to quote one of you, and I won't tell who, weirdos with beards and stubborn, is how he described it. And that was your consensus. Mm-hmm. Well, let's never say that stereotypes don't work. Now, we can't say that either. Now, Strecker then was, as it were, an Orthodox minister, a member of the establishment, a member of the establishment. First of all, that is the other important thing. First of all, he tried to do something for the workers, for the poor. He started off as what we call in Protestantism the inner mission, that is to the workman's mission, in charge of workman's mission in Berlin. And he founded a party, political party if you like, that was to better the lot of the working man, was to better the lot of the working man, which attracted. It attracted petty bourgeois, but it also attracted workers, especially railroad workers. Here we come to something else that I can't explain, but I'll say something later. Hitler also started the National. You know probably the National Socialist Party started as a workers' party, just like Strecker, like Ruega in Vienna. All these started as workers' parties. Hitler started with 25 railroad workers. National Socialist ideas were first prominent among the working classes, not among the middle class, among the working class. So there was obviously a terrain here for the working class. And Hitler and Ruega and Strecker and Berkel, who we'll hear more in a minute, all started off in this way. But they found something very true. Hitler, Ruega, Strecker, Berkel, they all found that you couldn't get this movement going, really, with only a kind of paternal socialist program. Or what they called socialism was really paternalism. And they found that you couldn't really get a dynamic with that kind of workers' movement tied to the establishment. Because it was tied to the establishment, after all, Strecker was a court preacher. Ruega would be mayor of Vienna. It was tied to the establishment. It wouldn't pull. And we have the statistics on how Strecker began to change. The crowd dwindled off when he lectured on the workers' problem. But once he switched over to preach against the Jews, the churches were filled. Hitler had the same experience in Vienna in 1920. Once he talked about his kind of wishy-washy workers' problem, his audience dwindled. But once he got upon the Jews, he could really do something with his 25 railway workers. And von Ruega had the same experience in Vienna. In other words, what you have here then is that these mass movements start with social concerns. They have, as always, a democratic veneer. They start with social concerns. But because their social concerns do not really have place for a radical social program of change, because essentially they are all tied to the establishment. They are establishment people. They soon find that the appeal to anti-Semitism is a dynamic and an explanation which will work,
Now you say why? And here I must remind you, we have laid the foundation for it. By this time, we must say anti-Semitism has become popular. And if you look back at what we said about the rise of modern anti-Semitism, it has become popular precisely as part of a democratic movement. Precisely. So that Stöcker in Berlin first, and then Wenger, and later Hitler, produced this trend which had penetrated to activate his movement, to make it dynamic. The two pulled the popularity of anti-Semitism, there can be no doubt, the foundation had penetrated. As I said, Stöcker found that when he preached on the Bible, small attendance of the Jews, large attendance. And so he adopted the usual idea. The Jews are guilty. For finance capitalism called the stock exchange. These people were no racists. Stöcker was a Protestant minister. Conversion put an end to it. But this was integrated with a push towards becoming a mass movement. Anti-Semitism and a concern for the poor were combined. His party was called the Christian Social Party and the Christian Social Movement. A conservative which now attempted to translate its paternalism into a mass movement, appealing to the working class and the petty bourgeoisie. It concentrated on the Jew as symbol, the Jew as exploiter. Typically enough, Stöcker praised the Orthodox Jew. The Orthodox Jew. It was the modern assimilated Jew he was after, who he thought was finance capitalism, who he thought dominated the stock exchange. It is the Jew as exploiter. This was to be a prototype for other anti-Semitic parties in the 1880s and after. These parties called themselves Christian Socialist Parties because they used Christianity and defined their socialism in terms of compassion, in terms of Christian compassion, together with anti-Semitism. But the weaknesses are here also apparent. There were meetings, preaching, from the pulpit, putting up candidates for the diet. But obviously there was a difficulty. It was regional. This was a Protestant move. The Catholic German South was excluded. Always a problem in Germany. Problem for Hitler, which he overcame. The others didn't. The Catholic South was obviously excluded from a Protestant move. It had bad organization, and we might say a very bad organization indeed. But it tried out propaganda, caricatures, prints, like Caesar of the Caesar's play I mentioned earlier. And indeed, for the first time, it tried out mass propaganda. Everything was annexed. There were anti-Semitic playing cards, anti-Semitic matchboxes, anti-Semitic flyers. I'll bring some in to show to you. I have a collection of these. But the importance is that now the penetration was still greater because everything was annexed. We are on the road towards modern mass movement with this emphasis. His propaganda was directed against the Jewish stereotype. And its main accusation was again the accusation of lack of ethics, which I told you about earlier. When Stöcker initiated the debate on the Jewish question in the Prussian Diet, he said that the Jewish question is, after all, a question of ethics. Islamic stuff. Stoecker failed. He failed for two reasons. First of all, his organization, which was poor, very. And secondly, because the establishment got frightened. Stoecker was repudiated by the Conservative Party. He was repudiated by the emperor. He lost his position at court. They got frightened because the establishment was rightly frightened by mass movements. He was frightened. And yet, what was his effect? And again, here you can see the ambivalence. The first was the founding in the 1890s of a new student movement, Christian and anti-Semitic, which became the most important student movement in Germany, the National Student Movement. That was one effect, which grew out directly out of the Stoecker agitation. And secondly, in 1892, at its Congress held in the Berlin Hall of Tivoli, therefore it is known as the Tivoli Congress, the big conservative party, which had rejected Stoecker and the mass movement. Nevertheless, in 1892, the Conservative Party adopted for the first time an overtly anti-Jewish plan. A plan which said that it was necessary to roll back the undue influence of Jews in German life. The Tivoli Congress of the Conservative Party in 1892 shows you what I have tried to say, namely that though the establishment rejected the mass movement, was afraid, was ambivalent about it, it nevertheless meant that no, these ideas penetrated where they had never penetrated before, above all the liberals and the conservatives at the Tivoli Congress. Now, Stoecker failed, partly because of his bad organization. But could you have a good organization? What did you need to have a good mass movement? Could you have a good mass movement which was not socialist, but which was also Christian and anti-Semitic? The man who pioneered the future and whom the Nazis rightly erected a museum to eventually was a man called Otto Becker, who had made his debut with a book called The Jews, the Kings of the East. Where did he get it from? You know, you learn it now, he got it from Schuster. He made his debut, and all these things go back and forth. He made his debut with this book, The Jews, the King of the East book, which he crimped from Schuster. But Otto Becker showed us that to have this kind of mass movement, you need what I like to call a fully furnished house. That you cannot have this as a partial movement, but a fully furnished house. And this Becker set out to do in the state of Hesse. In the state of Hesse, among the Hessian peasants, and to do successfully. At the height of the Becker movement in 1893, he himself pulled 290,000 votes for his seat in the Diet. What did he do? What did he do in the years 1887 to 1894? He succeeded in forming a movement of which anti-Semitism was an integral part, a movement which Charles Morin in France called so nicely a politica tout faire, a politics which covers everything, which gives indeed to men a fully furnished home. What did he do? He organized peasant cooperatives, consumer cooperatives. He took factories under contract. He organized consumers' cooperatives that the peasants ran themselves. He organized touring lectures. he organized mass movements frequently in connection with these cooperatives. He organized credit institutes. He organized two free cattle markets, very important in Asia, where the Jews were the cattle dealers. Two free cattle markets. In other words, you didn't ever have to go outside and move. The movement took care of everything. Your economic wants, your spiritual wants, everything. There was the ladies' auxiliary, all of that. It took place of all your needs and all your wants. Built around what Bekel called the peasant league. That is to say, this peasant organization. No wonder the Nazis recognized here a precedent. The collapse was not due to any inherent fault in the experiment. It was the personal failing of Becker, his loss of nerve and money matters, which led to the failure. But what we have here is anti-Semitism built in. In other words, the left. The left. If you want an ongoing mass movement, you must provide a fully furnished house. If you can combine the Christian appeal, and Becker, like Becker, was an Orthodox Protestant, if you can combine the Christian appeal with the kind of anti-Semitism we have analyzed, then you can have a movement which will continue and not merely be a riot, but make, as it were, a go of it. And this movement by Bekel in Hesse pioneered to this great extent. But there is one movement which ought to be more important, I think, than either Stöckel or Bekel. The first modern mass movement which was successive over a long period of time and which came to power. The movement associated with Karl Weger in Vienna. Now you remember, those of you who went round last term for me, reading Mein Kampf, that Hitler admired Weger more than any other man, and rightly, much more than Bekel. Weger is the rehearsal for Jewish destruction, though no Jews, as you will see, were destroyed, and Weger was cynical, as a phrase, I determine who is a Jew, comes from Weger. And though Weger was cynical, this cynicism was only for the inner circle and not apparent to the outside world. What about Paul Weger then, whom Hitler so much admired? Hitler realized that both Becker and Weger were the waves of the future. And let me say again, they were the waves of the future. And Stöcker too. Then, for these reasons, perhaps I better summarize, for these reasons, first of all, they document the crisis of liberalism. Secondly, they document the new importance of nationalism and the new importance of mass movement. They document, thirdly, the depth of the stereotype, and they begin to use a formula which will have a great future before it. A formula of social concern. They were anti-socialists, so as you will see in a minute, the social concern had its limits. Of social concern, which they put in the guise of Christian, because that was certainly anti-socialist. That was certainly a barrier to socialism. Christian social concern. And the Jew as an explanation for the evil of capitalism. This combination. But unlike Stöckel, and then the most successful of all in Vienna, the Weger movement demonstrates that unlike Stöckel, you need a fully furnished house. You need a carryover. For what is the difference between a riot and a movement? A movement has to work in good times and bad. about the riot, and then you go home and you talk about the riot. You bullshit about it. Well, that's really very harmless. That's why I always say, why get excited about our riots here? They have no importance, really, in the long run. You riot, you bullshit, but it's not a move. Not a move. So that Beckel, the others, showed how to build a move. Now the importance of this is clear, is it not? That for the future, to build a move, you must combine social concern, democracy, as we said, anti-Semitism was always a movement of revolt, was always tied up with a movement of revolt. Social concern, democracy, and anti-Semitism. That is the formula to which the future of mass movements and mass politics belongs. And not just in Germany, but in all of Europe. A formula that was in the end so attractive that even the Communist Party tried to use it. In 1923 and 1930 to 1933. So attractive and so relatively successful. For these movements were cross-class movements. Not one-class movement, not restricted, but cross-class movements. I myself believe, must be clear from what I've said, that you cannot understand the problems and let us say the tragedy of Western Jewry in modern times without understanding quite clearly that the Jewish faith became involved with the faith of mass movement and mass politics. And that it became involved in a rehearsal of destruction. And now you see why I think that no Jew should really go in for mass politics and mass movement. But you can draw your own list, for the formula here has never been superseded. We shall go on to Gregor next time.